Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Hubert Phipps, multimedia sculptor and painter with studios in New York and Virginia. Hubert attended the Deerfield Academy in Massachusetts, the San Francisco Art Institute, and did an internship at the New York Studio School. He has had a varied professional life, beginning as an automobile racer, then a helicopter and airplane pilot, and in his 40s returned to studying art and has shown his works in solo and group exhibitions such as the Ann Norton Sculpture Garden, the New York Studio School, Coral Springs Museum of Art, and more. His work has been found in collections such as the Tufts University Gallery and the Colorado Springs Museum of Art. He's working on a very unusual project at the moment, and he's here to tell us more. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Good morning, Susan. Thanks for having me.
You've created a fascinating, innovative sculpture entitled Dream Wall. Would you like to tell us a little bit about this project of yours?
Yes, Dream Wall is a sculpture that I created a few years ago. My original vision was simply to, like most all the art that I create, I'm first looking for an aesthetic that I find interesting and engaging. And this started as a clay model in the maquette size. And I started working it to a certain level of completion. And then I brought in a friend of mine who's a very talented digital artist. We scanned the object and we brought it into Maya, one of the available three-dimensional programs, and we further worked this dream wall of object in that program. Then we cast it in bronze, and there was a thought, Susan, that this sculpture might do well large scale. So I partnered with a foundry in Hangzhou, China last June 2019, and we decided to create this in fabricated copper plate, 25 feet long. And simultaneously, I was starting to become aware of artists who were working with light projection, and particularly the ability of computers and projectors to map projection and animation to the form, strictly to the form. And I reached out into the art community and was introduced to Jeff Grants, who really is at the cutting edge of this type of technology. And he introduced me to a musician and a company out of Boston called Masari Studios, who's headed up by Samo at Masari. And we decided to do a collaborative project based on this object. And it ended up becoming a six-minute production, which involved the projection, the light projection, and the sound design. Dream Wall is a title that I came up with. The original title for the piece was called Border Wall, with no intention on my part or any political connotation, just the shape of the object itself, to me, kind of harkens to a wall such as the Great Wall of China. We decided to rename it out of an untenable title in our political environment now, and I'm really pleased that we have this new title called Dream Wall, and the direction that I gave the collaborative team was, let's work off a theme. We have an object that we were all resonating with, and the theme was that of transformation. And given the very minimalistic directive to these artists, whom I never had met before, they went about doing their part in this project, and the result has been Dream Wall. It's a testament to the dedication of Jeff Grants, who was co-leader on this project, a testament to Samo at Masari Studios, and a testament to Jason Krigler, the musician, to their shared vision of what we were trying to accomplish. And we put this whole project together within 4 months, and that was from the inception of the theme, the commission of the work in China, so that was fabricated on a fast-track basis. It was shipped overseas 30 days on the oceans, and we were able to present this project, having installed it on a special purpose-built reflection pool at my studio in Virginia. We were able to present this project at a fundraiser that I was hosting for the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. And this has opened up a whole new venue for me, new opportunities. The team were very enthusiastic about this project and moving forward with new projects along these lines.
Where do you think this might lead you to? You're very inventive with medias that you use.
Who knows? I think the idea and the willingness for artists to embrace technology, and in my case, I'm working in a lot of traditional means in terms of most all my projects start as a two-dimensional sketch. But the opportunity that is presented now with the technology that is so fast changing, this is giving artists amazing opportunities. That's a question I'm not even sure, because who knows what will come around and things that are being developed that will become available to us. I do believe that materials are extremely important, and I love exploring different materials. I love the idea of translucent in art. One of the materials I've not worked with, but I'm very interested in going into resins and acrylics and continuing this exploration with light that can maybe be projected through an object, possible resin or acrylic objects as the conduit. So who knows? Time will tell.
Could you tell us a little bit about your pigment drawings and how you began those?
Pigment drawings was a big departure from my previous two-dimensional work, in that I made a conscious decision to create a new body of work, initially try to get a project started without so much conscious thought. Early in my career and going back to my teenage years, I was more or less an illustrator, and it took a while for me to develop this affinity for abstract art. The idea that I could let just the creative powers that are work through me, the ability to be able to facilitate that for me was to reduce the amount of the senses, if you will, the human senses, at least initially. So these pigment drawings I create by covering the paper with pure paint pigment, and it's just a dry rub application onto the paper. I've been taping them onto 8x4 foot plywood sheets. Once I've accomplished this, I start the work at night. I turn the lights out. I place erasers around. So initially I'm working in complete darkness, and to further, how would I say, reduce the elements down, I start and I disrobe. So it's me, my body, darkness, the paper, the paint pigment, and I'm on it, hands and knees. And I reach out, locating the erasers, and using those erasers, I start making the marks by dragging them across the paint pigment. And I do this for about 30 minutes and 40 minutes. And I turn on the lights, and I see what has occurred. And I look at that, and then I finish them off visually. Process that's taking the conscious mind out as much as possible. And it's become a ritual, if you will, for that series of pigment drawings that I was able to create.
Moving to your sculptures, you've used a variety of materials. Is there something you like to work with particularly, or something that led you to create some of your innovative works before Dreamwall?
There was a period of time that I just adored working with clay. Important to me was my ability to learn how to weld, to be able to make very strong armatures onto which I could put clay on, and with an oil-based clay that is the same clay that the automotive industry uses in their styling studios. However, I needed that ability to weld. So I started to learn how to weld, and it was just to be able to make crude armatures onto which to place the clay. As I developed that skill, I really enjoyed the welding and the fabricating. And now I'm moving into a process using forges and hydraulic presses, and that's my new direction, something I've recently have tooled up for and looking forward to producing works from forging.
A very diverse background of skills and interests that led you to some dynamic career choices. Do you think your background or aspects of your experiences enter into your work consciously or unconsciously?
I'm of the belief that these things must necessarily somehow influence us, even if it's on a subconscious level. So I love machines. I love speed. I love aviation. I love the forms and the aesthetic shapes of airplanes and the aerodynamic forms of flying machines and the aerodynamic forms of automobiles and particularly race cars. I think this comes through in the artwork, specifically with the rocket form. And as a pilot, I've been able to experience a view of Earth at a low altitude, at an intimate distance, if you will. I fly helicopters, have been flying for the last 15 years. And that intimate distance and proximity to Earth and the designs that it presents in terms of the farmer's fields and the irrigation machines that make these specific marks, I think that has subconsciously influenced my artwork. And recognizing that prompts me then to go and more consciously use that resource material, if you will, whether it's embedded in my memory databanks or if it's from the thousands of photographs that I take during flight. I don't think we could discount the invisible world, whatever that may be. It hugely influences us more than we may recognize.
You mentioned your photography. It's quite abstract. There's a few on your website. Can you tell us how you create those photographs and what you were photographing?
The photographs that you're referring to were, I believe, most all of them were artifacts, if you will, that resided on walls and buildings that were shredded paper and graffiti and other markings. This is all in Manhattan. So when I see something that was interesting in terms of texture, in terms of designs, or the whole ripped paper, which creates these marvelous layers and textures. So those are just very simple photographs that I will take haphazardly and or not with my iPhone. And then I bring them into Photoshop. And I use that wonderful program to then manipulate those images. And the idea initially was to create ideas and references for oil paintings. However, the photographs themselves, I think, came out to a level of quality that I appreciated enough to put on the website.
I'd like to thank you so very much for speaking with us and sharing your story and inventive techniques. It's been a pleasure, and we wish you continued success.
Oh, thank you, Susan. So nice to share that with you this morning.
Thank you very much. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Susan Kerr, Creative Director and Product Design at Pinterest, the highly acclaimed pioneering graphic designer and influential computer iconographer who created the legendary Macintosh icons and thousands of other software icons for leading companies that have become familiar to anyone using technology today. Susan earned her MA and PhD in Fine Arts from New York University, and after a short term working as a sculptor and curator, began her graphic design career at Apple Incorporated as a screen graphics and digital font designer for the original Macintosh computer, then embarked on an independent career opening her own design firm, Susan Kerr Designs, which led to many collaborative design projects with leading technology firms such as Microsoft, IBM, Logitech, Facebook, and PayPal. She is known as the Matisse of computer icons and the woman who gave the Macintosh a smile through her intuitive, whimsical iconography. And in 2008 was named the winning medalist for the American Institute of Graphic Design, the most distinguished award in the field presented to individuals in recognition of their exceptional achievements, services, and contributions to the field of design and visual communication. The Institute recognized Susan's work for her bold and intelligent design of icons throughout her career and for the early Macintosh computers that defined the Apple user experience and set the industry standard with memorable wit and humanity. She made the graphic user interface accessible to the masses and ushered in a new generation of pixel art. Susan has also written the book Susan Kerr Icons, a collection of her favorite icons from 1983 to 2011, with explanatory notes, published in 2011. Hello, Susan, and welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you so much for the chance to chat with you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You have had a remarkable career as a graphic artist and iconographer, designing thousands of legendary icons and typefaces familiar to anyone using computer and modern technology. Can you share your fascinating story of how you began your journey and became known as the Matisse of computer icons?
Thanks for asking. I was a typical kid liked art, any kind of art materials and crafts, and I kind of credit my mom for encouraging me in that area. So I graduated from college as an art major, and I didn't go to art school, but I always sought out opportunities to do graphics like posters and card designs and things through practical applications. And thanks to a high school friend, Andy Hertzfeld, who was a system software programmer at Apple, I had the chance to join Apple and join the Macintosh group. Andy approached me since we had gone to high school, and he knew that I liked art, and we were neighbors in California. He showed me an early Macintosh and said he needed somebody that could create images for the screen and typefaces. And he explained that it would be analogous to drawing in squares on graph paper to make these images, and that there were just 72 squares per inch. So the resolution was pretty good, and it was black and white. And it was a lot like needlepoint. I really just kind of took to it. I tried it. He suggested I get some graph paper and just try and make some images that way, and I really enjoyed it.
Your icons were a first taste of human-computer action for most, and they were approachable, friendly, and simple. What goes through your mind when you're designing your icons, and how would you describe your approach and philosophy?
Well, I think that I was lucky in, first of all, everything that I did at Apple was collaborative, and I worked in the software group with just, I thought, such talented, thoughtful programmers, because I'm not at all trained as any kind of software engineer, but I learned by working in software a bit more about their approach. There was a strong desire for this Macintosh computer to be path-breaking, and that it was consciously designed to appeal to people who were non-technical and would never type in a computer command, but might be able to interact with pictures. So I tried really hard to make everything simple and relatable and non-technical. And just the constraints of that medium, making everything out of little black and white squares, kind of limited you to pressing things in a really economical way.
You've placed a premium on context and metaphor in some of your designs. Can you give us a few examples of how you chose some of your designs and the sources that you may have consulted?
I was a good example of the target audience for the computer. I designed things like a wrist not to be a cursor to show that time was passing, but that everything was okay. I saw there are a few existing examples, and certainly Xerox PARC had screens with icons. They had a piece of paper with a folded corner. I definitely didn't invent that, but I redrew it. And they had a trash can. So I kind of pushed, but I think I took some of these basics. I certainly looked at the hourglass and thought, well, who uses an hourglass? Let's get a little more modern and have a wristwatch. And I continued to use pieces of paper for documents, but I kind of developed a symbol that had a hand with a pencil doing something on the document so that the application could be a verb and the little piece of paper itself was more like a noun, things that you could drag around on your desktop. And I just tried to make a printer or a pencil or some of the icons for tools in Mac Paint, like a pouring paint can or a spray can, things that people might recognize a few salient visual details and be able to, you know, at least have a pretty good guess at what that thing might do. Or I usually hope if someone tells you what it is once, then you remember what that is.
With the opportunities that you've had to work with such innovative tech companies, exchanging ideas with some of the brightest minds, who are some of the people that stood out for you over the years and may have informed your ideas? And what were some of the significant lessons they taught you?
Good question. I feel as if having my own design business was great in the sense that I did work for lots and lots of different companies. Some projects that were maybe a handful of images and some lot of icon projects. I think after I left Apple, I worked at Next, which was the company that Steve Jobs founded after he left Apple. And I worked for Next both as an employee and a contractor. And just because you asked, I was able to help Next develop its logo. So I thought that it would just be wonderful if we could hire a designer named Paul Rand, who's always been a tremendous graphic hero to me. And we were able to work with him. He was in his 70s. He lived in Connecticut, but he came out to San Francisco and met with everybody at Next and designed their kind of looked like a black cube with the word Next on it. He drew the letters, and because that computer was going to be shaped like a cube. I learned so much from working with him because he was very decisive. For example, when he did Next logo, he presented one thing. I would usually say, as a rule of thumb, always present a few things so you can say to the client, which of these could work for you, as opposed to, do you like it? Because you don't want to hear a no. Paul, I thought, was just a master of making images that were meaningful. He did Westinghouse and IBM's logo, and he kind of impressed on me. He was always like, don't just design something that maybe looks cool, but doesn't mean something. And he always suggested that if you could combine a word and an image, that was really strong, because without spending money on advertising, you're reinforcing your message. So great to work with him. Probably another project that stands out to me that was more recent was I worked with Facebook for about 4 years on a series of virtual gifts. And this was before it was easy to upload your own graphics. So it was the opportunity to send an image, it was 64 by 64 pixels, along with a message to anybody else that was on Facebook. So for pretty close to 4 years, we would release at midnight a new gift. It was like having a virtual gift shop, cost a dollar. So my challenge was, what can you draw in 64 by 64 that will prompt someone to spend a dollar so they can send it? So I did all kinds of different jewelry and food and lava lamps and penguins. Penguins, always popular. And our most popular gift ever was a kiss mark. That probably sold the most.
With your design company, did you do a lot of limited edition prints of some of the icons that you were well known for?
You know, I kind of have a separate business that continues. Thanks for asking. It's called careprints.com. I probably started that maybe around 2010, just making a few different sizes of some well-known Apple icons, as well as some other icons that I just designed, thinking that they have really big pixels in real life. So if you see the print from a distance, it still reads almost as if it was on a screen.
You also wrote a book in 2011 about your collection of favorite icons. And what did you enjoy most about writing this book?
A friend had the idea, you might want to make a book. And I had a wonderful writer, Steve Silberman, who used to write for Wired. And actually, he's a really versatile writer. He fairly recently wrote an interesting book about autism. But he is a good tech writer. So he wrote an essay that's at the beginning of my book, just talking about the different kind of how the Mac changed things. And I was so lucky to be able to work at this transition from screens with, green glowing characters to introduction of more graphics on a screen and image-based computing. So in my book, it was 2011, so TikTok. It's been a few years, but I just include illustrations of icons from all kinds of different jobs, from Apple onward. Some of them low resolution, very pixelated, and some of them created in Illustrator, more like splines, vector images that have a higher resolution, more like the Facebook GIF.
If you were to advise young artists and graphic designers on how they might become involved in computer graphics and design now and use their artistic talents most creatively, what might you suggest they start with or get involved in?
Well, I love, just today I had breakfast with a recent grad. I enjoy chatting with people in this field. I mean, it's very different now, because when I started shortly after the earth cooled, there weren't really university programs in graphical user interface design. Very different now, more tools. To me, it is not essential to study computer user interface design per se, but I love to hire people who have experience thinking about solving visual communication problems, because that's what it boils down to. I think a good way to get experience is to volunteer your services for doing posters and icons and any kind of digital work for worthwhile causes, just to build up your portfolio. It's interesting now that really anybody can develop a website or put your work on Dribbble and get your work out there. And it's so much easier to see other applications and things people have designed and even try your hand at how you would do it if you were going to do something over to have portfolio work.
Are you working on any special projects or books that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, for the last 4 years, I've worked at Pinterest, and Pinterest is kind of thinks of itself as the home of inspiration. And I like Pinterest very much because I just love collecting and saving different images. I feel as if inspiration is everywhere. Neon signs and the beach and needlework and petroglyphs from a few thousand years ago. And Pinterest is sometimes a good tool for collecting all this kind of info so that you have it. I've been working a lot on how Pinterest might use the pushpin more significantly as a metaphor. It's always been on the save button. And I think it's a great symbol for saying, I want to save this because it's a little special. Just the way in real life you use a pushpin to just tack something up on a wall that you don't want to forget or you want to think about or you want to look at. And I've done projects here from icons and cursors to some environmental art. I've been making in our buildings 9-foot-tall pins made out of things. I did one where it doesn't have an outline, but I filled it with probably about 250 red objects. And I just finished one where I made a pin out of clocks. They're kind of like murals, but these installations are metaphors for Pinterest boards.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for speaking with us and taking the time to share your insight and story with us. It's been a pleasure having you on our show, and best of luck in your upcoming projects.
Thank you so, so much. And again, thanks for your kindness in inquiring. Take care.
You too. Thank you. That was Susan Kerr, graphic designer and computer iconographer, speaking with us from San Francisco. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.